briefly, they were subjected to sound in the higher frequencies, and they fainted. And now, back to the adventures!
Welcome, everyone, to How to Read Comics, a part of the Overthink Network. Here, we are the podcast that asks all those comic book questions your nerd pride is too embarrassed to ask. I'm Nick, your comic book newbie, and with me, as always, Dr. Comics himself, Jason.
Hi, I like Dr. Comics. I haven't had students call me that. I'll use that.
I think you have a bright future in a comic based on your real life, maybe.
I hope so.
Well, at least you have the name for it.
Yes.
How to Read Comics was created because of me, or rather my complete surprise to the width and depth of the comic book world. I got to enjoy reading a few comics on my own that were gifted to me. Had a great time doing that, but as soon as I went to go get some more, I started running into a bunch of questions. Where do I go next? Where do my superheroes come from? And where do I get their story straight? Do I start at the way, way back, go all the way to the back to the beginning, or can I pick up right in the middle? Anyway, lots of questions popped up as I started to dig into comics. And so I asked my buddy Jason here, who's been reading comics for quite some time, to help me out. He was gracious enough to do so. We said, hey, there's probably other people out there that would benefit from some of this knowledge too. So we get together every week and chat about comics. This week, we're going to talk about where the heck did comic books come from? Right, Jason?
Yeah, and I'm excited to answer this. This, much like last week was how to read comics. How do I read a comic? Mm-hmm. This week, where did comics come from is another really big question. And so likewise, we're going to try and give you some frameworks to understand this so we can jump in at different points. And of course, answer a lot of other smaller questions along the way.
All right, Jason, then where did comics come from?
All right. I wish I had a nice, succinct answer to this. There's a lot of places you can start. Some people have even argued that Egyptian hieroglyphics and a particular Mayan codex are proto-comics. They got words, they got pictures, they've even got speech balloons telling you what a character is saying. A classic example from the 13th century is the Bayeux Tapestry, this like 200-foot-long tapestry that depicts the Battle of Hastings. And again, it's got characters and word balloons and stuff like that. So you can go all the way back there.
Well, I'm glad you didn't give me that for homework.
Yeah, no. I'll leave that to others to read, especially because it's in Latin, which is extra fun. So the more contemporary stuff, comics don't have a nice kind of cut and dry beginning. Instead, they have these fits and starts. One of the other questions you asked is, you know, what's the difference between a comic book and a comic strip that I would read in a newspaper? And that's where you see the origins of comics, is in those comic strips and newspapers. They have origins before that, but that's really where they started being popular. Comic strips in newspapers. Those strips then started to be compiled into longer books. So you wouldn't have to just wait for the newspaper. If all you wanted to read was the comic section, they would print a bunch of comics together. And this is in the early 30s. They'd put all those comics together, print them out. Those were incredibly popular. People loved them. So then they started actually writing original stories in those. One of the earliest is Action Comics number 1, 1938, with Superman. And that is, to a great extent, where the history of comics starts. There were other comics before that, but what we think of as comics really, really took a big turn right then, and it started to look similar to what we now think of as comics.
So was Superman then like the first superhero?
Yeah, he's usually seen that way. The big influences on him, and this is one of the other things that's weird about it, is Superman was an amalgam kind of two different stories, which is the comic strips you'd see in a newspaper, but also the stories you'd get in pulp magazines, where they would have sci-fi stories, they'd have detective stories, and they would have these kind of superhero stories and adventures and things like that. Those were mainly text with just an illustration here and there to kind of liven up the magazine. And then Superman had its origin in both, but it was the first comic book superhero, I would say.
Gotcha. So did comics start taking off on their own, or did Superman kind of mark the start of more frequent comics?
Yeah. Superman was a huge success, an overnight success. DC, which is the publishing house that owns it, also published a comic called Detective Comics, which is where the name DC comes from. And DC...
I'm going to write that down.
Yeah. 27 issues into their publication Detective Comics, they had a new character appear named Batman. That was shortly after Superman, and these were the two big ones. You had Marvel Comics taking off at the same time. I can't remember the exact name of it because it changed names a few times. And you had seven or eight big publishing houses in the late 30s and into the 40s. And then you also had World War II. One of the reasons that's important here is, or two reasons, is first for content, the stories start being about World War II. So Superman fights Nazis, right? All that kind of stuff happens during World War II. You actually get comics about current events. The other thing is, who's reading these things? Well, who's reading the funnies? Supposedly it was children.
Who's buying them, right?
Who's buying them? Yeah, yeah. Well, supposedly it was children. But the fact is, adults like them too. And especially GIs during World War II. So that's a big part of the popularity. Marvel and DC would distribute these comics at reduced prices or at sometimes subsidized prices to get them to GIs who would trade them around and really enjoyed them. They were very, very popular with GIs. So now we can start breaking things down into some historical eras. What we're talking about now is called the Golden Age of comics. The comics history is, in America, is generally broken down into a series of ages, usually about four. You got the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and the Modern Age. And again, all of those eras, any dates you're going to put to them are wrong. The kind of the cleanest one we've got is the creation of Superman. Everything else gets a little bit messier, but I'll get into some reasons for the distinctions that we want to make, because we do want to say comics in the 70s were very, very different than comics in the 30s. So kind of what historical things happened to change them.
Yeah, and that was part of our homework from last week's podcast, was to read something from each era of comic books. So if you didn't get a chance to listen to our first podcast, run back, listen to that real quick, or at the very least, press pause. There's links in our show notes from last episode, and just go read a couple of pages from some of these eras that we just talked about. It really makes you appreciate whatever comic books you're reading now. But then it also gives you an understanding of the progress throughout the ages.
Yeah. So let's start with Golden Age comics. And I want to go to your questions first. But first off, Golden Age comics starts in 1938 with Action Comics number one. And it ends in 1954 with a book that's not a comic, a book by Frederick Wortham called Seduction of the Innocent. We'll get to that book in a second. And why, again, we've got a really nice, clean ending for an era.
That is a cliffhanger and a half right there.
Yeah, we'll get there in a second. First, I want to talk to you. You read a couple of these Golden Age comics.
Yes.
What are your thoughts? What did you read? What did you look at? What did you see?
I did. So I've got, in my short comic book time, I've got an affinity to Batman. So I went and checked out the that Detective Comics 27. It's interesting. The first thing I noticed, it was almost like I was reading a comic from a bazooka bubblegum pack. That's what it felt like. It was like, oh, okay, yeah. So there are going to be these little panels, and you can almost hear their voices speaking out to you, like, ah, so Batman, what are you doing here? You know, it's very old feeling and looking, and it doesn't. I mean, other than the colors and the format of, you know, reading one panel to the next. Other than that, it's almost something completely different than a lot of comic books today.
Yeah.
Which it should be. They're 80 years old. So some of the other things I noticed is stories were so simple. You could see it coming a mile away. Although I'm not going to spoil anything, but the way that they start Batman off.
Spoil away. It's 80 years old. You're good.
It's 80 years old. There's no spoilers here, but knowing everything you know about Batman and Bruce Wayne and how they're the same person, if you've never heard of Batman before, like, and nobody did when this comic first came out, the way that this comic book starts is really, really funny, because it starts with the commissioner and Bruce Wayne just talking. And you don't know that Bruce Wayne's Batman. And I wonder what the surprise, like the genuine surprise people had finding out, oh, this guy that was talking at the beginning of the comic book, he was Batman.
Yeah. Well, nice little twist, right?
It's a twist. I mean, we see it a million miles away because of pop culture, but to people that never had read anything like it before, I thought that was one of the thoughts that came in my head. I'm like, oh man, how funny, or how surprised were people actually when that happened?
Yeah. So some things you noticed, you talked about the narration being a little bit weird, stilted in terms of the prose. You know, it sounded like a 1930s radio voice.
it sounded like I was reading or it read like I was listening to a radio show.
Yeah. And not only that, though, did you notice that there was just a lot more narration than you're used to?
Yeah. It would be nice if somebody went back and took out a lot of the exposition. I think it would actually flow better to a modern audience and might actually be a bit more interesting and not so tiresome. I shouldn't say interesting. It's kind of tiring to read all that exposition. Absolutely. The Batman walks over here, you know?
And yeah, no, so this is one of the kind of cardinal rules of comics is the narration should not describe what's happening in the panel. The panel should kind of in some way speak for itself. The narration should give me the details I don't have from the panel. So these classic 1930s, 1940s Batman and all the other comics, though, what you'll see as they're still kind of sorting this out is the narration will say something like, then Batman jumped in the Batmobile. And then you've got a picture of Batman jumping in the Batmobile. And then you've got Batman saying, Robin, I'm going to jump in the Batmobile. Right. You know, everything is repeating itself just to really make sure you get it. And they hadn't learned to trust their readers yet. I don't know that it's, you know, because we're so much more sophisticated. I just think at the time, the comics creators weren't that sophisticated and didn't trust their readers enough. I think readers in the 1930s could have been just fine with cutting a little bit of that exposition.
One last question about Batman before we keep talking about Golden Age stuff is when did it go from the Batman to Batman?
I wish I had a good date for you. I did like 2 seconds of Googling on this, but I believe he was well into just Batman by the end of the Golden Age. You'll still see it thrown up in recent comics every once in a while, but just to harken back to those originals, it's always got a kind of a flare of nostalgia in it when you say it. The Batman.
Cool. So anything else about Golden Age comics that I need to know?
Those are the big things we added. One thing we focused on is superhero comics, but those were not the only comics of the time. Comics had, you know, children's stories. The entire kind of Disney pantheon had their own comics, Donald Duck comics, that kind of thing. There are also Western comics. Detective comics is, you know, the title of it. And obviously that means that there was a genre where it was detective stories. Batman originally was always solving crimes. And that starts to drop off in Silver Age, especially, and into Bronze and Modern Age, where Batman is now battling people rather than solving crimes.
So like the supervillain.
Yeah. 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 No, fewer supervillains, more just a murder to solve. The other detective comics that wouldn't necessarily have a superhero would just have a detective who's good at solving things. The other really big genre at the time, though, was horror. And we don't think of horror comics now as, you know, a primary genre. But if you ever saw the HBO TV show Tales from the Crypt, you're aware of that TV show? All right.
Oh, yeah.
That was based on a comic from the 40s and 50s from EC Comics.
So my nightmares as a child came from a long time ago.
Yeah.
They were created before my birth. That's probably why they're so hard to kill out of my brain.
Absolutely. And the Crypt Keeper, the main character from Tales from the Crypt, was a character in these old comics who would introduce and close each of these comics with that stupid pun and things like that. You're just dying to see what we're going to talk about. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's a really important genre for comics, not only because they were so popular, but also, remember, most people think that comics are for kids. And this psychologist named Frederick Wortham wrote this book called Seduction of the Innocent in 1954. Seduction of the Innocent was all about how comic books were turning children into maniacs and murderers. Mm. Every serial killer ever had started because of reading comics. And he builds this really big case that has no substance whatsoever, total BS, but it causes a national craze. People start burning comic books in giant piles. There's a Senate hearing about this. And the result is the comics industry voluntarily took on this thing called the Comics Code Authority, which would kind of rate comic books like the MPAA did for motion pictures. Now, unlike the MPAA, though, they didn't break it down into ratings. So with motion pictures, you've got G, PG, R, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. With comics, it was just, do you have the Comics Code Authority or not? The other thing is, and if you
don't, like a pass fail.
And if you fail, basically you can't publish because all of the major publishing houses have agreed to abide by this thing. Not only that, though, the kinds of things that were included in it, you know, violence, sex, you know, that kind of stuff was all being forbidden. But it's not just necessarily like, you know, nudie pictures or anything like that. When I'm talking about sex, it's a character cannot be presented as having a sexual relationship outside of marriage, and inside of marriage, it shouldn't be talked about. You know, that kind of really, really
twin beds in the bedroom sort
that
of
kind of thing.
I Love Lucyism
exactly.
of comics.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
Homosexuality could not be presented. Hmm. Disabled characters were not allowed, and the bad guys were not allowed to win. So
that one's interesting.
Horror comics was in a way just right out. Now, there were also some racial things that came into play. Let's see. There's a famous comic called Judgment Day from Weird Fantasy. Think of this like a Twilight Zone episode. That's kind of what they were publishing. They had this story where an astronaut goes to space and he meets these aliens. And the aliens are super racist and these other aliens aren't allowed over here. And the human astronaut talking to them about, oh, you just got to solve your race stuff. Then he gets in a spaceship and he blasts off after not solving anything. And he takes off his helmet because he's in the spaceship now, and you see that he's black. And so there's this hopeful presentation of, okay, maybe Earth has figured this out at some point.
Right.
But also, that doesn't fix all racism. And it's also a reminder of the racism that we have now. Well, that was in 1953. And then it was being, that was before the Comics Code, and then it was being republished in 1956. Uh-huh. And when they republished it in 56, a judge ordered them to change the final panel.
Oh my gosh.
Because it was too controversial. The creator of the comic told the judge, quote, if you do not give that issue the code seal, I will see that the world finds out why. And the judge reversed his decision. He wanted it to all be under the table.
Wow.
And then that comic folded anyway because of lots of financial pressure that was put on it because of some of these decisions they were making, where the other comics didn't want to do that.
They got the seal, but they got hurt in other ways.
Yeah, and it was we're not going to give you the seal anytime we can in the future.
Right.
And because of that, the guy who did this, I've been quoting William Gaines, who's the publisher here. He quit EC. EC folded. Some of its titles got picked up by Marvel, I believe. And then he went on to publish a new comic book that would not be ruled by the Comics Code Authority. And it was called Mad Magazine.
Oh.
And that's where Mad comes from. And that's why it gets away with being, you know, gross and weird and all that stuff that Mad Magazine could do throughout the 50s and 60s.
They just said, we're not doing the code. We're separate.
Well, it's Mad Magazine, right? It's not a comic.
It's not. It's a magazine.
It's a magazine.
Wow.
Even though it's full of comics. They didn't apply for the comic code. They didn't do it. So that's why we get that really, really nice break at 1954.
Huh. So my next question then is, so how long does the Comics Code Authority last for?
Yeah, the last Comics Code Authority seal, I believe, was in within the last decade. But it very, very gradually petered out. Again, since it was a self-policing thing and people could always publish their comics without the Comics Code, it was just that they would face public scrutiny or something if they would.
Right, or not get funding or something.
Yeah. In the 80s was the first mainstream comic that didn't have the Comics Code Authority seal on it.
Okay.
And that was an Alan Moore comic called Swamp Thing. And with it not passing the Comics Code Authority and them deciding to publish it anyway, they split off and started a brand new imprint of DC that was called Vertigo. And that was a few years later, but that was kind of the impetus for it. They started wanting to do a separate kind of comic that was just for mature readers, and it would say for mature readers only on the top of it. So they could still keep the Comics Code Authority over in their regular books, their Superman books, and then they could do these other books for mature readers, and that led to The Sandman, Watchmen, all those kinds of more mature books.
So let's get back to, so Golden Age is done. We are no longer in the Golden Age. We are now in the Silver Age.
And Silver Age is after Seduction of the Innocents, so anything after 54 into the early 70s. The big thing to know here is the new characters and the fact that Marvel starts to take over. Marvel has the Amazing Fantasy 15. That's where Spider-Man first premieres. Has X-Men 1 during this time. Lots and lots of new characters coming out from Marvel. And characters modeled on teenagers. Notice that Spider-Man and the X-Men, both of those characters are teenagers. So as opposed to having these heroes that people can pretend to be and say, when I grow up, I want to be Superman or I want to be saved by Superman. You can imagine yourself as Spider-Man right now. And Spider-Man has the same problems that you have.
And that's something distinctly Silver Age comics.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. That's distinct to the Silver Age. And in some ways, that's a way to get around the Comics Code Authority in the sense that we can't go weird, we can't go horror, we can't do this, we can't do that. But how do we still make our stories interesting? So we're being kind of forced to do something else. Well, let's make them real in a different way, which is let's make them about kids. About high schoolers. Give them exciting adventures.
Yeah, and so this part of the homework I did, I read X-Men 1, which is, it's great. It's got, I mean, there's still some things with it that it's just like, man, I couldn't read this every day, but...
In some ways, the dialogue is a little bit better than Detective Comics 27.
Yes.
It sounds
a little
like
more modern.
Yeah. A little bit more 60s with all the sexism inherent in that.
Yeah.
There's also the creepiness of Professor X also thinking Jean Grey is pretty hot.
Yeah.
That's not great. That's not great. Weird.
Yeah. But they were just in thought bubbles. So yeah. It's not like he said it out loud.
Yeah. So the comics of the 60s are really campy. They're kind of over the top and having fun with themselves. And they're not taking themselves very seriously. But Marvel does start taking itself more seriously. DC at this time slips into having Superman has Bizarro Superman, who he's got to face, which is everything different about Superman. So if Bizarro Superman says, me love Superman, what he means is that he hates Superman. Me hug Superman would mean me destroy Superman, right?
And thus Backwards Day for every school children in the world was created.
Exactly. Bizarro Superman is just all Backwards Day. That's all he is. But you've got Supergirl, but you've also got Super Dog. You've got Batmite. You've got Bat Dog, all of these different things. And none of the stories make sense with each other. They're all silly. And there's no sense of continuity. They start kind of contradicting each other. Well, in this one, it says that Batman lives here and does this, but in this one over here, it says Batman lives here and does that. And so we'll get to a place when that becomes important.
So this time period, still kind of the Wild West of comics still, just everyone's kind of just,
you've got, or DC and Marvel have become the two big movers. And those will be the two main publishing houses until the 90s, when we'll get a third, and then we will get a little bit back into the Wild Wild West and other publishing houses.
And we're not talking about the comic book Wild Wild West.
No. We'll save that for its own episode.
I could sing the theme song for you.
Please don't.
Okay, I will.
So the Bronze Age starts at some point in the early 70s. And again, this is a really hazy date. At some point, comics stop being campy and start being more serious. Marvel goes there first and really was doing it in the 60s, where they started having more serious storylines. With Giant Size X-Men number one, that's where an X-Men takes a huge step up. And you have the creator Chris Claremont come in and revamp X-Men. And that leads into series like the Dark Phoenix saga, where now we've got a hero who turns evil. We've got death. We've got real romantic relationships. We've got affairs. We've got all kinds of stuff. It becomes more of a soap opera. The X-Men, who were, you know, feared because they were different, really take on more of a civil rights vibe. Throughout the 70s, something that was kind of subtext in the 60s becomes more clear in the 70s. Spider-Man's girlfriend dies, all kinds of serious stuff. And
you had me read that comic. That was intense.
I know. And it is. And it's really intense, and they take it seriously. It's no longer campy. You can feel that huge shift between Amazing Fantasy 15 and Amazing Spider-Man 121. That's a very different issue. And then DC tries really, really ham-handedly to do the same stuff. So with Green Lantern and Green Arrow, it's still a little bit campy, but they try and tackle serious topics. And they do it really, really poorly for the most part. There's a famous issue of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, where the sidekick gets addicted to heroin. It's a very special Green Lantern, Green Arrow.
On this Christmas special of...
Instead of finding out that... what was the Saved by the Bell one? Jesse's doing caffeine pills.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Imagine that instead of caffeine pills, it was heroin. I mean, it's like, whoa, that came out of nowhere. This was not a dark comic. This was, you know, well, let's tell the kids that, you know, don't do drugs by going as far off the deep end as we can. So Marvel usually held it pretty well. DC tried to imitate them and didn't do it very well. That's kind of the story of the 70s. DC is still going back and forth between doing really serious stuff and being really campy.
Some of the things that I noticed about Bronze Age comics, reading these in order, was all of a sudden, boom, colors, like really vivid colors. Not only the colors, but they started, they're, instead of like having six panels on a page, they would have like one big panel and like four small panels on one page. And they were really just, they really played with the page to see what they could do. Notice that in that Spider-Man 121, just beautiful, like super bright, awesome. And something tells me there was something behind that. You know, why was this common across all Bronze Age, you know, stuff in the comics in the 70s, or was it just specific maybe to the Spider-Man that I was reading?
No, printing quality definitely went up. And it would continue to go up into the 90s is really where it started to kind of plateau into the quality that we see today.
Cool.
And it was gradual. It happened in fits and starts. But there's this nice parallel between the complexity of the art and the complexity of the story, where the early Supermans, it's, you know, red, white, and blue are the colors. And red, white, and blue is the stories. And by the time you get to Amazing Spider-Man 121, now you've got tons and tons of other colors. You've got great line work by John Romita. You've got really cool panels and everything's changing. There's a lot more complexity on the page and there's a lot more complexity, in the story. And I'd say the Bronze Age is a great place to start reading old comics. If you want to start reading old comics, Giant Size X-Men is a great place to jump in with X-Men. I mean, you can skip pretty much everything before that.
It's still decidedly retro and nostalgic. It may not be something you're going to read every day, but it's like, okay, this is a classic comic right here.
And then 1985 happens, and that moves us from the Bronze Age into the Modern Age.
Sweet.
A lot of stuff happens in the mid-80s. We've got Alan Moore writing a bunch of comics, both in England and in the U.S., that take comics very, very seriously as a medium and try to do interesting new stories that haven't been told before. Watchmen comes out of the same time period. I believe it's 1987. Dark Knight Returns by Frank Miller. Now we've got a very serious Batman in 1985. The other really big thing that happened in 1985, though, was Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was a DC crossover. So real quick statement about what a crossover event is. Crossover event is going to be the bane of your existence as a comic reader if you're reading the mainstream titles. So you're reading Batman, and you have how many Batman series do you have to read if you just want to read Batman? Right? There's a series called Batman. I just want to read that. Boom. I know every once in a while there will be characters jumping in from other Batman series, but I can just read that one and I can get all the stories. Until they do a very special crossover event.
Oh, no.
Where now I've got to buy five different ones. So you're reading the Star Wars comics right now, right?
Yeah.
Is it the main Star Wars title?
No, actually, I'm reading Dr. Aphra.
Okay, so you know with Dr. Aphra that we just had the Screaming Citadel crossover.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden you got part two of five or part three of five or something like that. You're like, wait, where's part one? What happened? Well, half of Dr. Aphra's story was over in the main Star Wars title and half was over here. And that's what they started doing with Crisis, is telling one story across multiple titles. Why would I want to do that as a publisher?
You're going to sell more comics.
Exactly. And now maybe if you go pick up the main Star Wars title, now maybe you'll start reading that as well.
Right.
Makes sense. Really annoying as a comics reader because you don't hear about it until afterwards. And now you can't get a copy of that issue because the comic store didn't buy enough and all those things happen. But Crisis on Infinite Earths, not only was it the first or one of the first major crossovers, but it also consolidated DC's continuity. I told you that they had all these different characters that kind of contradicted each other. And they had so many silly characters. And if Batmite, this stupid tiny version of Batman, appeared in the comic, does that mean that the real Batman knows him and that they're actually hanging out? How do I figure out these continuity issues?
Right.
So what Crisis on Infinite Earths did, it took all this weird continuity stuff where nothing matched up and nothing made any sense. And it said, okay, those weird, goofy Batman stories, those all happened on one Earth, and it's Earth 17. And then there's Earth 24, where that was more like where Batman and Robin were, but when Robin, for like one issue, wore blue instead of his normal colors. And then, you know, and it's like everything was solved. Everything just happened on a different Earth. And
so
then
if you're reading something, you're like, oh, wait, why is Robin wearing that mask? Well, it's because he's on a different because he was on a different Earth, or because they were on a different Earth, was just the way to explain everything.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
And they start to number some of them. And they start to give you some of them. And then they have this crisis, this supervillain who actually puts the multiverse at jeopardy, not just one Earth. And the only way that the heroes can defeat him is by killing all but one Earth, by collapsing the entire universe.
Oh my God.
So some heroes are able to get out in time and some are not. And Supergirl doesn't make it. And so Supergirl has to be reintroduced later when they decide they actually liked Supergirl. You know, things like that, where they can now, we don't have to have Bat-Dog anymore.
This is 1985, you said.
1985. And that fixes it. And now DC can start over and be serious. And that's when you start to see better continuity and more interesting arcs in DC. This is an issue that Marvel never really had to deal with because most of their stuff was within continuity. It was all canon.
I'm already losing my continuity. I'm sorry.
Don't even worry.
I'm going to have to collapse myself into one Nick so that I can keep it all straight.
So I mentioned some of the interesting kind of mature comics that came out at the time, Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns, which we will read for next week. This then leads into the 90s. In the 90s, there's a huge surge in comics publishing. A lot of this is led by speculators. There was a big recommendation throughout the 80s of, you know, hey, look, Action Comics is selling for tens of thousands of dollars. Action Comics One. You know what the best thing to invest in would be? Comic books. Buy a comic book, put it in a plastic sleeve, stick it in your basement, and just wait 40 years, and it will be 10,000 times its former price. Well, so then comics are selling more. So then they're making more comics, and they're now having not just more comics, but variant covers, right? Have three versions of the same comic.
Yeah.
And they'll all, each will be worth more.
Right. And so they're still doing that today.
They are.
25 years later.
It's not as bad. You don't have a chrome version and a gold version of the same comic. And it costs $8. And you can only buy even though the regular version only costs $2. And so it's not as bad as it was then. But the entire industry collapsed then. When people realized these are not worth anything.
The great comic bubble of 1990...
Early 90s. I don't know.
The comics, 90s.
The comics collectors bubble is what it's usually comics. Called, or the speculators bubble.
See, so here on How to Read Comics, my questions don't even go that deep. I didn't even know that this was going on.
Yeah. So that covers the history of American comics, and we have not even begun to scratch the surface of other traditions in comics. For instance, manga, which starts in Japan, or if you ever read those Tintin comics, these are called Franco-Belgian comics in France and Belgium, also called in French bande dessinée or BD. So if you ever see that abbreviation, that's what that means. Each of those has rich, amazing histories that we're not getting into today, but we do want to dig into at some point because they're cool, they're fun, and often more interesting than the American ones at the same time, especially in that kind of dead period of the 60s where everything was so campy.
Was there a dark age for comics where they just, you'd mentioned that there was a period in the 90s where they were just pumping them out, but either in sales or in storylines, was there a dark age of comics?
I would say in many ways the 60s and 70s were the dark age. Now, that's not to say there weren't great stories happening then, but they had gotten kind of ghettoized into children's literature to such an extent that they really, really weren't taken seriously. And at many points, they didn't take themselves seriously. So that begins with that Frederick Wortham book, Seduction of the Innocent, and that leads to that kind of dark age. That's about as dark as it got. There were kind of financial crises in the late 90s after the collector's bubble, but that didn't necessarily put comics as a whole in jeopardy in the same way.
Okay, so cool. We made it through all the eras of comic books from the beginning to all the way up to now. I've really kind of gotten a better understanding of, you know, the thing that when I crack open a brand new comic, it's really helped me kind of put it in context to what's come before. So, you know, hey, if you still haven't looked at some of these older comic books, please do just a couple pages. You really start feeling like you're a part of this long tradition of what you're opening up in front of you, because chances are the people that created the comic that you're reading today, they were in tune to all this stuff as they were growing up, or as they were actually writing these
Yeah, and one thing I want to add is you go back and look through those, something you might not notice is the line work. Pay close attention to the line work and the way that it changes for the illustrators from those books from the 30s into the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You'll see really, really simple line work in the 30s, and you're going to see much more nuanced, interesting line work where they kind of figure out their own kind of language, especially John Romita's stuff. If you look at that Amazing Spider-Man issue 121, really, really cool, interesting line work that he's doing that he's crafted himself. So that's one thing to pay attention to if you want to say, okay, how did they develop? How did the visuals change?
Yeah, check out the show notes for today's episode. You can find them at howtoreadcomics.com. We'll have links on there of some places online that you can see the differences in some of the things that we've talked about today.
Well, it sounds like maybe enough of your questions. Do you want to jump into the mailbag?
Yeah, let's go see what our listeners have to say. All right, welcome to the Back Page. This is the part of the podcast where we go over listener questions, recommendations, and we'll give out homework for our next episode of How to Read Comics. Let's start, though, with our mailbag. We've got a couple questions here. To be honest, you know, we're just starting the podcast up. And so we talked to some of our friends that are also doing podcasts for the Overthink. And we got a great question from Dominic, who is a co-host on our film podcast. And Jason, here, why don't you read this one?
All right. So Dominic asks, what's the process for writing a comic? Illustration, story, dialogue, etc. How many steps? What's the order? And I thought this was a really solid question. We had a few different ones to choose from. I like this one because it can seem so obvious. And yet when you're looking at this finished product, you're like, wait, how does it exactly get done? There's a very standard, simple system. And then there are lots of variations on it, is the short answer. But the very standard, simple system is you start with a story. If you're at a major publishing house, this story might get worked out around a writing table so that you make sure that the person writing Spider-Man doesn't destroy New York and then the X-Men can't use it or something like that. But also, if you want the X-Men to show up for something, you want to make sure that Spider-Man and the X-Men are on the same page. So you talk out big story arc stuff there. Then you go and you write a script for it, and you give the script to an editor. Now, the script would actually have dialogue in it. It would look like a movie script, but it would also have descriptions of what the page should look like, what the panels should look like, and it will read very much like a movie script. What is Peter Parker's facial expression in this, etc. The penciler then gets it. The penciler is often separate from the inker in terms of artists. So if it just says artist, they might be doing both, but it might say artist and inker. You can see the credits in most comic books. They'll have them right up front. The penciler gets this and draws typically a series of thumbnail sketches to just kind of plot things out and say, okay, I think I want it to go here, but I'm going to be real dirty with this. Might show a couple ideas to either the editor or the scriptwriter to say it. Are we on the same page? Does this work? Does this make sense? And then goes through and illustrates the entire comic, paces it out. If the scriptwriter didn't break it up by page, decides how many panels, if the scriptwriter didn't do that. Some scriptwriters, Alan Moore notoriously, actually spell out every single panel on the page, how it should look, how it should be shaped, what the composition of each panel should be. Spider-Man's shoulder should take up roughly 2/3 of this panel, going from the upper left to the lower right, you know, that kind of thing. You can get that kind of detail, or it should say, this page should have a series of panels, and we got to get from A to B, and there we go. So very different ways of writing scripts depending on who's writing it.
Yeah, and if I can just pop in real quick, if you want a cool example of this, again, we'll have links, but follow the artist Greg Capullo on Twitter. I've been following for a while. He does a lot of the Batman comics that I've been reading. I really like his art, but he will actually post on Twitter some of his penciled out sketches. So you can kind of see half of a panel before it's actually done. It's real interesting, especially if he'll actually give a little previews of future issues that are coming out. So it's kind of cool there, but it's interesting to be able to see kind of the skeleton of the page is coming to life. It's really cool.
Yeah. And I'd recommend you follow multiple artists because you'll see how different each of them does it. Some of them will make their art by actually taking photographs of people in poses, and then they'll draw Spider-Man as that pose. Some people do it completely just out of their mind, you know, not looking at something to copy, but just creating a pose that even a human being couldn't do. The other thing we're going to have in the show notes is a link to a repository of comic scripts, so you can see different scripts for actual comics and how they're written and what they look like. So the penciler has now gone through and actually drawn the entire comic. This is what we think of as creating a comic. Now, the inker comes back through and inks the comic, going over each of the pencil marks to decide what's most important, what's not. And when I said line work earlier, this is what I'm talking about. Because if you did just the pencil work, it doesn't print very well. It doesn't look great. It looks good on your page, doesn't look good when it's reproduced on multiple pages, and it doesn't look great with color. So the inker goes back, inks everything, and erases all the pencil marks. Around this time, a letterer then comes in, adds all the letters and all the narration, and all the speech balloons, which are now going to go over the work that the penciler did. So they may have drawn a really cool thing that never gets seen because it gets covered by a speech balloon. And then you've got a colorist who goes in and colors everything that's left. Often these are different people, all of these different roles, but they can be consolidated. And sometimes you'll have one creator who does every single one of these roles. There's a lot of variations in this process, but this is the general process.
Cool. You know, that was a question I've had, and I'm glad we got to talk to Dom about that, because it validates the crazy thoughts in my head that, you know, who actually really wants to know all this stuff? Anyway, great. So if you want to be featured on a future episode of How to Read Comics with your question, you can do a couple things. You can tweet your question to us at How to Read Comics on Twitter, or you can send us an email. You can just type up your question, send us an email, or you can record a voice memo on your phone and email us that at mailbag@howtoreadcomics.com. If we choose yours, you could ask us the question yourself here on the podcast. We'll play your beautiful voice on our podcast, and can't wait to hear that. Last but not least, we have the homework assignment. This is where we're gonna assign some comics for you to read so that you're prepared for our next podcast. So Jason, what's our homework?
Well, our next podcast is How to Read Batman. So we're going to read some Batman comics. Yes. There's a few different arcs we'll talk about. We're going to talk about Nightfall. We're going to talk about Dark Knight Returns. We're going to talk about the Court of Owls. But what I want you to do for homework, because that's a lot to read, especially Nightfall, that's hundreds and hundreds of pages. Check out Detective Comics 27. We've already linked to it. We'll link to it again in the show notes. Read Dark Knight Returns. That would be the most important to read for this, and the one we're going to spend the most time on. And then also read Court of Owls. If you want to do bonus work, go read Nightfall. It will suck up all of your time between now and our next episode, so you won't have to wait. You'll be happy when you finish it to just listen to us.
Perfect. Yeah, so I've got two out of the three done already. Boom.
Boom.
But I need to go back and read The Dark Knight Returns for sure. I started that, but I didn't get to finish it, so looks good. All right, so that's going to do it for issue number 2 of How to Read Comics. But before we take off, I like to close each episode with asking Jason, hey, tell me something that I definitely don't know about comics.
I told you earlier that after someone pencils a comic, you then put ink on it, and then you have to erase all those pencil marks. Mm-hmm. That was Stan Lee's first job, erasing the pencil marks.
That's very tedious.
And he grew from that into a comics empire.
Just a great rags to riches story here on How to Read Comics. We'll see you guys next time. Thanks.